Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. In this episode, Cancer Network's Tim Cortes spoke with Dr. Jorge Cortes from Georgia Cancer Center about the evolution of the chronic myeloid leukemia field. Specifically, Dr. Cortes highlighted how the development of imatinib paved the way for other tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Additionally, he described the necessary steps for achieving the next potential breakthroughs in care, which included stopping therapy effectively in more patients.
Prior to the development of the first TKI imatinib in 2000, what did the treatment landscape look like for a newly diagnosed patient with CML?
The standard of care prior to TKI development, there were two options. One was interferon, usually combined with low doses of cytarabine, and the other option was transplants. And neither one was great. Interferon was very toxic. It had low response rates. The real significant responses, which is what we call the complete cytogenetic response, happened at best in 20-25% of the patients. And again, with a lot of toxicity, it was an injection. And so, and then when patients did not respond or did not tolerate, there were really no great options. The other option was transplant, which is a good option. Transplant is curative, but particularly in those days, was still very limited by age, limited by availability of donors, and limited by the toxicity and even the mortality rate, which it has improved since then. But in those days, it was a very serious consideration to think about a transplant. So we were facing difficult choices for the patients, and many did not have great options. So the outcome was not good overall.
Great. And then after the first TKIs were invented, just in general, how do they perform in clinical trials? And then once they were approved, how do they kind of change treatment?
The impact of imatinib was very noticeable from the beginning, even in the phase one study. I was very early in my careers, but I was working with my mentor, Dr. Moshe Talpas. And I remember as we were seeing those patients in the clinic and having patients starting to respond, even in the very beginning of this early trial, patients that have gone, many of them even already through transplant and relapsed and interferon and so on. It was remarkable. And then that led to the approval of imatinib to be used for patients who had received interferon and not responded or not tolerated the treatment. And then it came to the initial therapy study, which was called the IRIS trial, and it was compared to interferon. It was randomized head-to-head. By then, it was very obvious that imatinib was a completely different game, much better tolerated, much better responses, and so on. So it was a very difficult study from the point of view that we all wanted our patients to get on imatinib. The patients wanted to get on imatinib. They would cry if they were randomized to interferon. It was impressive from the beginning. And sure enough, the study clearly demonstrated the benefit of imatinib. So that's when it came to the approval. And so since 2000, we've had imatinib available as part of our standard therapy. The initial approval was for patients with failure of interferon. Of course, that category doesn't exist anymore because we don't use interferon initially, but it became the standard of care for frontline therapy.
That's great. I love hearing about the rapid advancements in medication all in every disease state, but it's so interesting, especially with the advances in heme. So with TKIs, from 2000 to 2025, they've changed a lot. So we can break this up into different categories if you want, because it's been the first generation, second generation, and third generation. So can you talk about how they've kind of grown throughout those generations?
Yeah. So imatinib, of course, was the groundbreaker, and then it really changed not only CML, but cancer in general, I think. But then, of course, as you can imagine, we started seeing patients who didn't respond. It's great, but not everybody responds. Some patients lost their responses. We started learning about the mechanisms of resistance, and that created the need for other drugs that could overcome those failures, either because of poor tolerance or because of lack of response or loss of response. And that brought the second generation, dasatinib, nilotinib, and a little bit later, bosutinib. And they worked very good. You know, again, we had drugs that would give us responses in patients who were imatinib had not worked well. And then they were compared to imatinib in the frontline setting, and they gave us further improvements. You know, imatinib performed very well, but these drugs were even better in many aspects. So that's what constituted that second generation. But then, even then, we still had a few gaps. For example, there were still patients who, after two or three of these drugs, they did not have a good response, who were not tolerated. And then there was this one mutation that started emerging. We started recognizing it in the lab, and more we started seeing it in the clinic, which is that mutation T315I. None of these drugs worked, and that created the need to develop new drugs, and the one that emerged was ponatinib, which was the third generation of drugs, very potent, very effective. That was also very remarkable because for the first time, we recognized that some patients would have arterial occlusive events, heart attacks and strokes and things like that. It had never been reported with the other drugs. Now we know it happens with most of these drugs, but at that time, we had not recognized that. So it created a commotion because on the one hand, you had a very effective drug, but you also had these adverse events that were life-threatening. It's not like just having diarrhea or some nausea or things like that, you know, a heart attack or stroke or serious things. So the drug was actually transiently removed from the market. The whole strategy was re-envisioned. And, you know, it eventually came back and we use it a lot and we've learned how to use it better. But it taught us about that. And then more recently we had and more than a third generation, it's a new mechanism of action, which is what's called the myristoyl pocket. So in that sense, it's a next generation because it works in the same settings as ponatinib, but through a completely different mechanism of action. So, you know, another step in the development to try to overcome resistance, better tolerability, and so on, that is also very valuable. So we continue improving and innovating, and we still want to get to patients to be able to have a normal, not only life expectancy, which we already have, but normal life, you know, good quality of life, stop therapy at some point, and hopefully everybody can get to that point.
Great. Thank you for that breakdown. And maybe this is an opinionated question, but what would you say was the biggest jump? Was it going from no TKIs to having the first generation, or would you say it was moving from the second generation to the third generation?
Definitely, starting with imatinib, that was the biggest jump. I have no questions about that because it started. All of these others have been improvements over imatinib. We still use imatinib a lot. It's the most commonly used drug. So that was the biggest jump. You know, after that, each step that I described is a jump. I think that potentially this jump with a different mechanism of action could be the next important step, just from the point of view of one, having a different mechanism of action, which changes the game. Two, because that mechanism of action changes the game because it is very unique to this protein. It does this pocket where it binds, it doesn't happen in any other protein. So that makes it more selective, more specific. And it has shown so far very good efficacy, very good safety, and so on. So that's an important step, so much so that there's other drugs that are being developed with the same mechanism of action, recognizing that's a very valuable new approach.
Great. Thank you for that. And then how has the role of multidisciplinary clinicians like nurses or pathologists changed as the landscape has evolved and the disease shifted from like deadly to more chronic?
We've become a lot more multidisciplinary. When going back again in history, interferon transplant, these were only done in big centers, big academic centers. Not everybody could do a transplant. Not everybody could use interferon. It was too complex, too difficult, too toxic, etc. So it was very specialized. Now, because these therapies have also democratized the treatment, the availability, but also because these patients live longer lives, we need to focus on other elements, drug-drug interactions. Our patients end up taking other drugs for other conditions. You know, they live longer and they develop other diseases, other needs. They need visits between visits, someone to call for an advice, things like that. So that's created that need for a good pharmacist who knows about these interactions, the nurse practitioner that can advise about side effects, who can call them in between visits and so on. The pathologist, because we had to develop new techniques to monitor the patients. Now we had better responses, so we needed to be able to monitor that. And developing and perfecting these techniques was a full path that took years. And we still need to rely on them, and we continue finding new abnormalities. So we need to work very closely with them. The cardio-oncologists, because with these cardiac issues, we need to make sure that we can manage our patients well. Many of them will have cardiac issues, but we need to be able to give them their leukemia treatment. We just need to do those things safely. So more and more, we rely on that multidisciplinary team that can work together and look at these patients and give them the best option long-term.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So then with all the TKIs that are available now for newly diagnosed patients, what factors do you say kind of guide your decision most heavily?
I think most important to me is a very open discussion with the patients. I want to understand not only the medical characteristics of my patient. You know, do they have comorbidities? Do they have diabetes? Do they have they had a heart attack? Those kind of things. But also, what are their goals? Do they want to live longer? Do they want to aim for the better chance of stopping therapy at some point? Do they want to have the least risk of side effects? What are the financial considerations for them, depending on insurance coverage and things like that? So I need to understand all of that holistically to be able to then select what may be best to fit those goals that the patient has. And that's the advantage of having options, that for one patient, what's most important for them, I could probably achieve with drug A, whereas for another patient, I need to use drug B because that gets me closer to the goals or gives me the best probability of getting closer to that goal. Patients want to stop therapy and have better quality of life. Well, I want to go with the drug that gives me the best chance for that. So those are the important things. But these takes a very deep conversation with the patients. My job is to explain what I know about the disease, the drugs, the pros and cons of each one, the possibilities that exist in terms of outcomes. And then guide them through that decision. It's a common decision, not something that I should direct. It's something that I should discuss with my patients.
Great, that's so interesting. And then my next question here is kind of, what are your top choices for treatment for newly diagnosed or pre-treated CML? But there are so many different cases for this that if you want to, we could break it down into like, if you're aiming for the longest amount of life expectancy or the best quality of life.
Well, one of the things I mentioned is that increasingly patients want to stop therapy, want to have an opportunity to stop therapy. And right now, probably the drug that gives us the best chance is asciminib because it gives us the higher rate of responses, the deeper responses even early on. It also has the best tolerability so far. So also in terms of somebody who wants the quality of life issues and so on. Now, there are patients who may have very high risk of arterio-occlusive events, and the drug that has the lowest risk for that is imatinib. So in those instances, that may be a special consideration. We hate to think about financial considerations driving decisions, but sometimes that is a consideration. And imatinib, because it's generic and it's the lower cost, that would be the choice. Fortunately, imatinib is a very good drug. You know, we are fortunate in CML that we have good drugs and better drugs. We don't have good drugs and bad drugs. We have good drugs and better drugs. So if I have to treat somebody with imatinib, I'm comfortable with that. It's a good drug. It can give good outcomes. Now, again, in some instances, in many instances, I prefer to use other drugs. But even when I need to use imatinib for some of these considerations, I feel comfortable. I think that they're getting good treatment.
It's so interesting that imatinib still stands up as a great treatment.
Yeah.
It really speaks to kind of how great the breakthrough was when they did it.
Absolutely.
So what do you envision as the next major breakthrough in CML care? And I guess a follow-up to that is, are we getting closer to a curative approach?
The two main breakpoints that I think will come and we're we're most intensively looking for in research are, number one, we can stop therapy effectively in some patients, but it's only in a subset. Grossly, about 25 to 30% of patients can effectively stop therapy and never have to resume therapy. Some years ago, we thought that was not a possibility. You know, 20 years ago, we didn't think that was even a choice. So 25 to 30% compared to that is great, but we would like to have that for a majority of patients. So whatever gives us that next big step to at least doubling that, that's the next breakthrough. The other breakthrough that we need is that we know that there are some patients that have other genetic abnormalities that we didn't know about 5-6 years ago. Now we know that a good 20% of patients have other genetic abnormalities, and those patients don't do as well. So finding what works in that subset of patients, which are the most complex right now, would be a breakthrough that we need, and it'll come. In terms of, are we getting closer to a cure? I think we are. Again, we can stop therapy effectively in some patients, which is probably equivalent to a cure. You know, if you've done well and you can stop therapy and the disease doesn't come back, well, that's essentially what we think about as cure. So we are there. We're just not there on every patient, on as many patients as we want. So we need to work on that, making it more available to more patients, to most patients. So yes, we are there, but we're not there for enough patients.
Great. Thank you. I don't have anything else for you, but again, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with me.
My pleasure. Then, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yes.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.